can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Pushkin.
This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by food writer and cook, Allison Roman. For the past two decades, Roman has been a culinary force. First in Los Angeles, then in New York City. Of course, you likely first encountered Roman's work hosting cooking videos for Bon Appetit, many of which went viral. She then collected some of the hit recipes and put them into her first cookbook, Dining In, which came out back in 2017, the same year she started as a food columnist at the New York Times. Through each endeavor, Roman's mission statement is to create concise, resourceful recipes for people, kind of like myself, that may not always have the right ingredients, the high-tech equipment, or really the time to invest in a laborious meal. I could also just say people that are new to cooking, like me. The approachability of her work and the humor she leads with is why many turn to her in the throes of the pandemic. We talk about that period later in this conversation, which naturally dovetails into a discussion around the criticism she directed at Chrissy Teigen and Marie Kondo in May of 2020, and then, of course, the subsequent fallout from those remarks. I know many have complicated feelings about Roman, her work, and especially these comments. We get into all of that in great detail in the middle of this talk. And I think by the end, you'll have a better sense of not only where those comments come from, but where she's coming from. First, we begin with her newest collection of recipes entitled Sweet Enough, a dessert cookbook. It's an ode to her early years as a restaurant pastry chef, which we also discuss in this conversation. Along with the chaotic conditions of working in the service industry, Allison's work at the Milk Bar under the tutelage of Chef Christina Tosi, her rapid ascent at the Times, the idea of cancellation, the lessons she learned from it, and a whole lot more. She likes to refer to her books as time capsules, and in the hour ahead, we try to chart her evolution all the same. So, with that, this is Allison Roman.
Thank you.
Allison Roman.
Hello.
Pleasure to meet you.
Such a pleasure to be here and to meet you.
How are you feeling?
I'm actually feeling really good today.
Why actually?
Because I've been on the road for a while and I haven't been taking care of myself. There's like not been a lot of sleeping. Book tours are very intense. And today I actually feel great.
You woke up at a reasonable time?
Yeah, I had acai bowl for breakfast. Not on purpose. It was kind of an accident.
Will you be returning to that accident?
No. That was a first and last.
A one and done.
Yeah. I'm glad I experienced it. I don't need to do it again.
Maybe you go back to it in your 40s.
Yeah, we'll revisit.
Okay.
Late 40s, 50s.
I want to start with this new cookbook of yours. It's called Sweet Enough, Desserts for People Who Don't Dessert, which evidently definitely describes me. But you said recently, I'm not measured or precise. My culinary style is more like jazz, whereas baking is classical. So with that, you're sort of cringing at your own quote.
Well, writing is so different. And then when you hear it, you're like, oh.
Well, to be fair, that was spoken.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Does that make you feel better or worse?
Better? Question mark. But I also stand by it. I think when I said it, I probably had a bit of like a tongue-in-cheek energy, whereas you just read it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, out of context, emotionally.
I'll try to apply more tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, let's loosen up a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why did you want to take this book on if jazz is your typical style?
Well, if you really want to take the music analogy to its furthest possible conclusion, which you might.
Which
I don't know.
Of course I do.
But so I used to be a pastry chef, like professionally. That was my first job in food. It was my first job like as a 19-year-old person living in the world. And the only reason I took the job was because it was the only opening they had in the restaurant. And I learned how to do desserts from like a very intense, very precise, very technical place, right? It was like fine dining, tasting menu restaurants, very intense. And now, 15, 16, 17 years later, I'm able to sort of take what I want from that and do what I want. And I think I've never said this out loud and somebody else is going to quote me and I'm going to cringe. But I think what makes jazz so interesting is that these musicians have all of the technical skill. They know how to do things well. They know how to read music. They know how to write music. They know how to play instruments. You take that information and you can kind of free yourself to make something out of the sort of parameters, out of structure.
So you freed yourself.
I'm a jazz musician, yes. And, you know, the boring answer to that question is my editor was like, you should make a dessert book. And they wanted it to be the second book. And I said, no way. As a bargain, I'll do it as a third book.
Is that how you negotiate?
Yeah. I say not now, but later. And then sometimes later becomes never. But I think this was fun because I also had maybe been a little bit fatigued of writing cookbooks because the first two were, you know, siblings. They're very similar. It's like a two full books of over 120 recipes each of like savory food, what to make for dinner, how to feed yourself. And to do a third book in the same vein felt like even I needed kind of a reset.
Mm-hmm.
And doing a single subject book like this really felt like a good reset.
Well, the book is pretty disarming. As someone who had never baked before.
Wow.
That is me.
Before, like, weeks ago, and now you're...
Before this Monday, when I started preparation for this podcast, I was, as you write in the book, the once-a-year bakers, the twice-a-week cake makers... For those who can only manage to open a carton of heavy cream and pour it onto some fresh fruit. I was like one of the once in 28 years bakers. That was me. So I decided to make one of these recipes.
Which one was that?
It is the raspberry ricotta cake.
Okay.
But in order to do that, I had to make a visit to my local Williams-Sonoma.
Why? Over a cake pan.
I had none of it. I had none of the things.
You didn't own a whisk?
I had one whisk, but it was kind of weak.
It plastic?
It was kind of plasticky.
Yeah. Did you buy like the set from Bed Bath & Beyond where comes with like a spatula and a whisk and a thing and it's like $4.99 and you're like, this'll do. Yes.
I can neither confirm nor deny. I am, you know, a single person living alone.
Mm.
I cook plenty, but I just never baked.
Yeah. The baking is tough for one person. I'll give you that.
So I'm going to walk you through this. I went to the Williams-Sonoma. I had been putting this off for a long time because I felt like the moment I walked through the doors of that store, like childhood is over. The adulthood's beginning.
Yeah, it's basically you had a bar mitzvah.
Yeah, I became a man. Because once you're walking through and you're getting excited about like Zesters, like you can't go back.
No, it's like fun's over, boys.
That's what happened to me this
week. Bittersweet for you, I'm sure. You said goodbye to the boy and hello to the man. It's tough.
It was really hard. So I go home with the new whisk, a couple of mixing bowls that I didn't own. I had some mixing, but they were just not very good. I upgraded. I got a meat thermometer.
Unrelated to this.
Completely unrelated, but I got excited. That's the problem with the store. It's a dangerous place.
I would say that's the good thing about that place.
You know, my bank account would say otherwise.
Right. But don't begrudge the enthusiasm you felt. It is so rare you can feel excitement these days. And if that's going to Williams-Sonoma and buying a meat thermometer, go with it.
I was elated. I walked out of the store on cloud nine. I go home and I make the cake that started it all, as you write, this raspberry ricotta cake.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to how that turned out at the end of this episode.
Oh, no. Well, that doesn't bode well.
No, it's just got to throw something for later. We got to keep something for later.
All right.
No, it turned out.
Well, I'm curious, but, you know.
Well, you can ask me later.
Okay.
But the simplicity of this recipe, is it emblematic of the kind of cookbook that you wanted to make? Because baking is, to many people, daunting because of the precision people believe it requires.
Right. And I am just not a precise person. I am antithetical to being a Virgo. I am sort of chaotic in the kitchen, and I'm also kind of lazy. And again, I think because I know how to do everything the right way, I ignore a lot of rules.
Ah.
I'm like, I don't have to do it that way. And I sort of make my own rules, basically.
Yeah.
This recipe to me is you don't need any equipment other than a functioning whisk, which is like the bare minimum. So I don't even consider that special. Sorry. And a cake pan.
I didn't have one of those either.
Well, of course not. Yeah, you didn't even have a whisk.
I had a whisk. I make eggs. Come on, I had a whisk.
Okay.
It just wasn't very good.
That's fair. And now you have a good one. You're a man. But this cake, it's made in one bowl. You don't need to like know any technique. And
yes.
I think that the ingredients in it, i.e. there's enough eggs and ricotta and fruit, that even on your worst day of mismeasuring or like miscalculating or something, it can't go so wrong. But you're looking at me like maybe it did for you. But
nope.
We won't know for a while because you're making me wait. But
I'm making everyone wait.
We are collectively all waiting together. That's true.
The recipe takes an hour to make.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing about baking that people hate. It's not instant gratification.
Right. But see, that's why at the end of this hour,
you're doing. You are a storyteller. There's a narrative arc here, and I am with it.
Most people do know you for your cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned that 18, 19-year-old self that started as a pastry chef.
Mm-hmm.
I want to set the context for that a little bit more. You grow up in the San Fernando Valley through the mid-90s. Your mother was a court reporter. Your father, a businessman. They split up by the time you're 2 years old. After graduating from this private Catholic high school, you head to Santa Monica City College in an attempt to ditch what you've called Allie from the Valley. Somewhere in that time, you have a boyfriend, we're not going to talk about him, who introduces you to a restaurant called Sona in West Hollywood. But I want to sit with that one specific day. I think it's in 2003.
Okay.
Where you meet Ron Mendoza.
Yeah.
What happened?
I went to Santa Monica City College, then I moved to Santa Cruz, and I went to college there for a year, decided I was going to leave college and go to culinary school. So I moved back to Los Angeles, and before I was fully enrolled in culinary school, I was like, I need to like line up a job, because how else am I going to afford culinary school? So I went to Sona, and I knocked on the back door of the restaurant, and I said, hello, my name is Allison Roman. I would like to speak with the chef. And Ron answered the door and he said, oh, well, he's not here, but I'm Ron. What can I help you with? And I said, oh, well, my name's Allison and I would love to work here. And I was so nervous. I didn't know what I was going to say. I had no plan. And he's like, okay. And I was like, I'm going to go to culinary school and would sort of just love to talk to you about your advice for me. And if you have any openings, I'd love to just learn and work here. And basically his advice to me was, don't go to culinary school. We opened a bakery across the street. We may have an opening there, but we don't have anything available in the restaurant. Long story long, basically, he gave me a job at the bakery across the street. I made $7.25 an hour to like cut marshmallows and fuck up every day. I was messing things up left and right. But I think they could tell I really liked being there. I really liked to learn. I was so willing to do anything and work for no money that they never fired me.
Before we talk about that job, How did you know to knock on the back door? Like, what propelled you to do that? That's a very active thing to do as a 19-year-old.
Honestly, I think, like, bold
gumption.
Yeah, of just being like, I want this thing and I'm going to ask for it, kind of. But my plan was to go to culinary school. And I was sort of implying that while I'm in culinary school, I'll intern with you. Like, I'll work for free. But instead, that turned into them paying me.
Paying you to cut marshmallows.
Yeah, they didn't trust me with anything. And nor should they have. I was awful at everything. I didn't know anything. I knew less than you last Monday.
It's good you can insult me while you answer. Of that job, you said, I walked home crying every day, but not once did I think about quitting. I figured I'll stop crying when they stop being mean to me, and they'll stop being mean to me when I stop screwing up. I wonder if that mentality, especially in 2023, may be hard for some people to process.
Absolutely. Oh my God, are you kidding me? Yeah. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that was sort of, like, I understood why they were mean to me. I understood why they were rude to me. I understood why they were annoyed by me. Because I made their jobs harder. I created more work for people. I took time out of their day. They had to redo things. Like, it was pretty bad. And if I'm them, I'm annoyed with me. But I was so set on being good, not for approval from any one specific person, but just because, like, I kind of was like, I'm going to be good at this one day. All I did was read cookbooks. And all I would do was, like, have my notebook and, like, write down ideas for dishes. And I would eat at restaurants. But, I mean, I was so broke at the time and I had no free time because I was working constantly. So I wasn't, like, going out to nice restaurants. I had very limited sort of vantage of what else was out there. This is also pre-internet. So, like, I would read Jonathan Gold and, like, go to a restaurant in San Gabriel Valley or try a restaurant that was on, like, the 50 best LA restaurants list in the LA Times. Like, information traveled much slower at that time. And so books were like a real portal into what else existed in the world.
But also, what was happening in your world sounds like pretty chaotic and aggressive and combative.
Mm-hmm.
Was some part of you attracted to that?
Absolutely. I think that any person that enters into the restaurant industry, especially at a young age, like, there is an element to you where you feel at home in chaos. You somehow feel at home with toxicity.
Why do you think that was?
You know, I didn't have what I would call a peaceful childhood. And I'm not saying the two are directly correlated, but they're probably not correlated. And if you pulled 10 people who work in restaurants, like, 8 of them would say the same exact thing. And it was also just like, I felt like a very creative person my whole life, but never really knew what my avenue was until I found cooking. Like, I tried painting. I wasn't very good at it. I've always been a writer, but, like, not a good one. It's just, like, a medium that I enjoyed. I wasn't especially musical. I wasn't especially physical. Like, I played sports, but wasn't very good at them. Like, I tried a lot of things and nothing really stuck with me until I started cooking. And that was when I felt fulfilled and gratified, stimulated, excited by something on all levels, like, intellectually, physically, artistically, creatively, emotionally. Like, it filled every cup for me at a really young age.
Most people listening have probably not had that experience of working in a kitchen like that. And it's fascinating to hear how the excitement and joy that you found in cooking was also wrapped up in this toxic environment. Like, it's all, it's all, like, they're sort of inextricably linked.
But it wasn't so bad. And I feel the need to, like, not that I'm defensive of it or that time, but there are a lot of people who've had really awful experiences in restaurants, and I'm not one of them. I'm an emotional person. I'm a crier. So to be like, yeah, I cried every day, it's like, okay, well, I'm a crier. I am sensitive to other people's energies and what they say to me, and I get my feelings hurt and this, that, and the other. So it does develop, you develop, like, a really tough skin in a restaurant, but also maybe a person who's not as sensitive as me wouldn't have that experience. But nothing was so egregious or so violent or so toxic that I felt scarred or I look back being like, I can't believe I endured that. It was just intense and not typical of a work environment.
In recent years, there have been so many
articles. You're like, the bear. It's the bear. No, I'm just kidding.
Sure. The bear, podcasts, articles, shows, movies that have aimed to unpack and expose the toxicity of this place. You said when those pieces of art came out, as they continue to come out, I'm not shocked. I'm not surprised. I'm not horrified. Nothing about it was shocking. And people don't even know the half of it. What do people not know? that they ought to know.
Because most of the time when a person is brought down in a media capacity and there's like one story that leaks, there's a thousand of them behind it. I think that's more what I mean by you don't know the half of it. And it's sort of like when these stories come out about restaurant work environments and you're mostly focused on, like, say, a sexual aspect. There's a harassment situation. There's an inappropriate boss or leader. And that's something that people can really point to and say, like, this is objectively not okay. Mm. And what lurks behind that is just, like, the everyday indignations of, like, the way people speak to each other. That is aggressive, passive aggressive, rude, cutting. And the flip side of this is restaurants can also be glorious and family oriented and very like supportive and special. And they can be a lot of different things. And again, my experiences have just been like not ever that bad. I was always one of the youngest people in the kitchen and almost always the only woman. It was like me and like one or two other women, but I was the youngest person by like anywhere from 5 to 15 years all the time.
Well, let's talk about one of those experiences because you're 24 years old. You moved to New York City. You land this job at a place called Milk Bar. It's there that you're working with founder and chef named Christina Tosi. What did she teach you about work ethic?
She taught me a lot about work ethic. She is probably one of the hardest working people that I had ever worked with and had like a very intense drive to succeed and to make the thing that she wanted come to life.
What did that look like?
Intense. It was really intense. It was not always fun. And sometimes it was the most fun I've ever had. I met amazing people there. It was like almost all women. From the time that I started there, it was like 8 of us. By the time I had left, you know, it had scaled so rapidly in such a short period of time that it became, you know, something very different. But that was her plan. She wanted to dominate. She wanted to be everywhere. She wanted to be in the stores. She wanted to have multiple bakeries in multiple cities. She was so clear on that. And she also instilled in us like a very like don't ever ask anyone for help kind of energy where it was like do it yourself. Answer your own questions, solve your own problems, do it yourself.
Was that approach atypical?
I think with a woman, probably. But another thing that happens in restaurants that it becomes, for better or for worse, very family oriented, where these are your family members and it's not just coworkers and there's very few boundaries. And so you tend to work more than you want to. You don't get paid as much as you should. You do things that you wouldn't otherwise do in a regular work environment because much like a family, you have like the pros and the cons of being like, but we're family.
But you're not.
But we're not. No, no.
So I think that line, and I think we've seen it more and more as people have gone back to work where companies say, we're family.
Yeah.
And it's like, well.
You're like, well, actually, this is my job. It's interesting that restaurants became uncovered as like a sort of hive of that mentality, because I know to be true that it happens all over the place, like in financial companies and other sort of businesses. And that's their model. And that's how they retain, like, you know, employee retention. And sometimes people really enjoy that. And sometimes people are scared of that.
Well, when it came to Christina, you saw that she had these very clear aims and goals to innovate.
Yeah.
As you leave that job, did that kind of 20,000 foot view inspire you to move forward? Did that inform how you would leave and then go into Bon Appetit or the New York Times or whatever you'd end up doing?
So I got that job because I was going to be in New York for a short period of time. I was like, okay, I'm moving back to San Francisco after New York. I'll take a job at this bakery, like part-time, it'll be whatever. And then, but within 3 months, it became clear that I was very much in love with New York. And she had offered me a job as like a sous chef manager person with salary and a health insurance plan. I was like, oh, well, maybe this is my sign that I should stay here. But it was not my intention to continue working in restaurants. I sort of moved to New York to then move back to San Francisco as like a way to get out of restaurants. After being there for about a year and a half, I sort of had to have like a moment with myself of like, what am I doing? I'm again working in a restaurant, basically. I'm again working for someone else. And I think at that time, it really solidified the fact that I never wanted to open my own bakery. I never wanted to open my own restaurant. And I really didn't want to work for anyone else in that capacity.
And so you leave and work for someone else
restaurant.
In a different capacity. You would do the pies and thighs?
Yeah. Because I needed to make money. I never had any support. I never had a savings account. I didn't have secret money from my parents. I didn't have anything to rely on. So I was constantly having to work just to make rent, basically.
The secret money part, I think, is really key
to understanding.
We don't
talk about that enough, I don't think.
We're putting it on here.
I'm very proud of that. There's nothing I'm more proud of, to be honest.
See, because especially in New York and Los Angeles.
Yes.
It is filled with people that seem to just be endlessly floating with cash that cannot be accounted for.
No, but it also sets up unrealistic expectations for people in a creative field specifically.
What do you mean by that? Explain that for people.
I think that if people are like, oh, I'm an artist, I'm a successful artist, I quit my job and now I write books, or I quit my job and now I open an art gallery, or I quit my job and now I decided to like start a company that like makes a blah, blah, blah. And you're like, wow, that's like the dream, right? Like we all want to quit our job and follow our pursuits and like be creatively fulfilled. And how do you do that? It's tough when the how do you do that is answered by, well, I have a stream of money that I can rely on so that I can afford to quit my job, that I can afford to sink money into a company and start it, or a space or a home and buy it. And that's not to shame anyone that has that advantage. I think that's good for them. But I do think it's always very impressive when people don't have that and they had to just like figure it out.
Well, so then through the 2010s, when you take these jobs at Bon Appetit, BuzzFeed, and then the New York Times, did they feel like jobs or did they feel like a career?
It felt more like a career. I felt like a tradesperson.
Right.
I was like, I can bake biscuits for you for money. And they always felt like I was always making a move that I felt like it was going upward.
Mm.
It was like an upward mobility thing. I have to work here in order to work here. Now I'm going to work here and then I'm going to do that. And it felt like I was going somewhere. And I think that's why when I was at Milk Bar, I was like, I've reached the end of, like, there's no more lily pads here for me. I'm not going to another bakery or restaurant. And when I got the job at Bon Appetit, it was the first, like, job that I had that wasn't in a kitchen or a restaurant. But almost immediately, I was like, this is for me. I felt like this was the beginning of my, like, new career.
What about it?
There were a lot of things, mainly that I didn't graduate college, and I was now working in an office building where people were writers and editors, and I felt really validated. I felt like I had worked my way up through something through the very back door. Like, I'm like, I work at the same like publishing company that makes The New Yorker. How did I end up here? Like, it wasn't even imposter syndrome. It was like, whatever is below that. Like, I was just like, holy shit, what am I doing here? But it was really validating because when I first started working in restaurants and I was 19, I was in LA and my best friends went to UCLA and UCSB and I would visit them. And all their friends would always be like, what school do you go to? And I go, oh, I don't go to school. I work. And they're like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I'm a pastry chef. They're like, oh. And some people were like, that's cool. And some people I could tell were like, you didn't get into college, or you weren't smart enough to stay in college, or you got kicked out of college, or something, as if that was like a second choice for me. But it wasn't. It was my first choice. I believed in it as like an academic style career choice. I was like, no, this is like a high-level creative pursuit that I'm beginning right now. And so to end up working at a magazine felt like, wow, I did it. I did the thing. I knew that I was going to get here one day, but when I started working in restaurants, I never aspired to work in a magazine.
When you're at the magazine, do you remember the first time you thought, I'm pretty good at this. Like, this feels right. Was there a specific recipe?
No. I mean, the first recipe I made there was for biscuits. They had a photo of biscuits that didn't match the recipe. And they're like, these don't match and we need them to before we publish it. Can you do it? It was like a test, but it was a test that they actually needed help with. And I did it. I was like, oh, this is obviously a cream biscuit and this is a recipe for a drop biscuit. And
I don't know the difference.
Exactly. But I did. And so I was able to like detective this biscuit. I'm a biscuit detective.
A culinary Columbo.
Yeah. Thank you. That alliteration is so much better than biscuit detective. I don't remember the specific time, but I just remember over the course of me being there for about a year, like, I had the same sort of injection of energy and excitement and enthusiasm as I did when I first started working in restaurants, which I had definitely lost over those 7 years working in restaurants.
You have this quote about that decade where you said, none of the moves I made were financially incentivized. They only made me more broke. I didn't have any help from my parents. There was no secret pot of money. It was just pure belief bordering on delusion that everything I was doing would one day pay off.
Wow. I'm just saying right now that if I ever write a memoir, you will be reading the audio book version.
So having gone through all this without a support system, when 2019 rolls around and the New Yorker calls you a phenomenon on par with high-waisted pants and Sally Rooney novels, What did you make of that?
I don't know. I've been very bad at absorbing the steps of my career with like each accomplishment or phase. And like, honestly,
that's what I'm here for.
No, thank you. Well, now that I'm like talking about it now, like, it's honestly very emotional. I may cry at some point today, but it feels incredible. Like, I'm just, it was never really the plan. Like, that wasn't my goal. I wasn't working towards that. I found myself there. It feels really validating to like deep down kind of know that, oh, I'm good at this and I like doing it and I care so deeply about it. And those three things combined, to care about it, to be good at it, and to work really hard at it, to have that actually result in something that resembles success, it's very difficult to really absorb.
Why does that make you emotional?
Because I'm proud of myself, I think.
And that feels heavy?
Yeah. Stop making me cry. I'm not crying. You're crying. Yeah, it does feel heavy. I think that it feels validating to be like, oh, I did it. You meet so many people along the way, and there's so many people that I've seen in the last week or two that I've been on this book tour in different cities, and people that I worked with at that first restaurant, people that I've texted with, people that have called me, like out of the woodwork. It's been a real like Alison Roman, this is your life type time for me. Mm-hmm. And every single person is like, I always knew that you would do it, or like, you've always been this way and I'm so proud of you. Like, it feels really good to have like, wow, I've worked really hard at something. I've pivoted so many times. I've made choices that I didn't know that were right at the time, but like with a sort of blind faith attitude, was like, this is going to work out. And it did.
After the break, more from Alison Roman.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that.
With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
When 2020 comes, you have this very bifurcated year because the world shuts down.
Yeah.
Many people, including myself, like turn to you and your recipes for refuge. Your caramelized shallot pasta single-handedly tempered my depression and expanded my waistline. I thank you for both.
Oh, you're so welcome. You're better for it.
I'm still working it off. And I was not alone in thinking this or feeling this way. You went on Colbert. You drank spritzes with Katie Couric. And people around the world are posting about making your recipes in this really fucking depressing, hard, somber moment.
Yeah. And it made people so happy and like buoyed their spirits in such a way that like it was as good for me as it was good for them. And it was like the most beautiful symbiotic relationship that I could possibly have ever wish for anybody to experience.
So that's like 3 months of 2020.
That's like the first that's like the first 4 months of 2020. And also my second book had come out in 2019 at the end. So I was like riding the wave of that. Like things were really good.
Yes.
Things were so good.
And then
they were bad.
Well, everyone's experiencing like a terribly tough time.
Yes.
You experience a different kind of tough time after you do an interview with the New Consumer.
Everybody's favorite newsletter. I'm joking. No one's heard of it.
I never heard of it.
No.
I had not heard of it until doing preparation for this interview. Mm. Anyway, I'm not going to recount exactly what you said line by line, but essentially you were critical of how Marie Kondo and Chrissy Teigen capitalized on their brands and essentially, in your words, sold out by having product lines at stores like Target. Of course, you then issue this apology.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we're nearly 3 years from all of that, how do you make sense of your sentiments in that interview? Like, how do they read to you?
They read very careless, frankly. They read like dumb and like flippant. It's like I was having mimosa brunch with the girls. Like, you know, it wasn't like,
but
if you read the interview.
Instead it was with the New Consumer.
Yeah, instead the whole world read it because of Twitter.com. If you read the article yourself, which if you're curious, you should, there's no specific quote that's particularly bad in the context of I said a sentence and then I said some more things and then I mentioned another person and another context.
It's a couple paragraphs.
Yeah. And then they were lumped together as if I, you know, two people. And I'm like, oh, they're both women of color. They're both in the lifestyle space. Why did you single out two women of color? Why didn't you bring in X, Y, and Z to this conversation?
Plenty of white people to bring in.
Oh, tons. Where do I start? But yeah, of course. And any person who's like an aware individual is going to look at that and be like, oh, that's not good. Like, that's not a good look.
Are you saying you weren't aware?
No, because I was like, oh, and this person and this person. I literally had a copy of Forbes magazine on my table because I was in the issue and Marie Kondo was on the cover. And I had just read this article from Amanda Mull and she was talking about how Marie Kondo launched this, a line of products to keep your things inside of.
Mm-hmm.
And this was all came about because the interviewer asked me, what's next for you? Do you ever envision yourself with like a line of home goods or a D2C something and blah, blah, blah. And I said, no. You know, basically because my whole angle for what I teach is that, like, you don't need fancy equipment. You don't need special equipment, just a whisk, in order to make great food. You can have, like, a cutting board and a sheet pan, and you can make dinner. So if I were to turn around and all of a sudden start selling you cookware, that would feel antithetical to my teachings. It would feel hypocritical. And I made a really big mistake by mentioning people who were doing that in their space. And, I mean, lesson one, don't name other people. A, it's not nice. B, it's not smart. C, it's not necessary. And D, especially when you're speaking about like how that's going to come across, like I just wasn't thinking. I was literally cleaning out my pantry. I had no press. I had no PR team. I had no support. I was saying yes to every interview. I was like sure, yeah, I'll talk to you for 20 minutes. And like, didn't think anything of it. I was just like gabbing and it was super careless and just had no idea how careless. I just had no idea what was going to happen from that interview.
But the context of the interview, wasn't it a business?
Yeah, it was basically, how do you run your business? What's next for you? Do you want to scale up? How do you scale? How does somebody go from writing cookbooks to like actually making real money or becoming a business?
And it's a pretty capitalistic newsletter.
Yes. And I think my sentiments were anti-capitalist. And I think that that was what was lost on a lot of people, because basically what I was trying to convey is that in my line of work as a cookbook author, the way into actual like capital M money, if that's something you aspire to, is through licensing deals. So somebody is going to make your line of pots and pans or put your name on a bottle of something or whatever. Like, you have to sell things that are marketed and made elsewhere.
Which you don't want to do.
And I don't want to do that. And I
and
never
you have.
You have
not made any? There's not anything?
No. And the irony being, well, people were like, oh, she's being a hypocrite because I had
a vintage spoon or something.
Well, it was a woman of color owned small cookware company who wanted to do a capsule collection with me. And they said, would you design like your favorite? And I had like a small percentage of equity.
Okay.
But I wasn't like profiting off of that in a necessarily meaningful way.
Because that was the line people used. They said, why would she say this if she is selling this?
Right. Because it was divorced of context. Yeah. A lot of the interview was.
Well, this is the point of the show.
Yeah.
To do that.
But yeah, I was like, oh, I'm going to do this small business that I really believe in. Because they were making high quality cookware at a really affordable price point, which I really believed in.
I see.
And
who's that? Do you want to?
Material Kitchen. Yeah. And they're great. I still, I think their cookware is wonderful. I recommend it to anybody, especially who's like starting out and wanting something on the more affordable price point. Their things are very beautifully made and they care a lot about how they're made. But it felt like in the moment, it was not the time or place for me to justify my words because people were hurting on a lot of different levels. And it didn't really feel like anyone gave a shit.
Well, let me ask you this. In the New Yorker profile that you had, you said, I still have not seen a successful story of a woman getting dragged to hell in the way that I was and then coming back publicly and being able to talk. Looking back, why do you think you were dragged to hell?
Because there's a lot of reasons. I think that the velocity of which I achieved success in a lot of people's eyes was very fast. And I think that that is what we do to people in that position, be it a celebrity, a singer, an actor, whatever you want to call them. If they are all of a sudden in the spotlight in a positive way for an extended period of time, there's like an arc where the public seems to be very happy with that. Then the narrative becomes like, are they that good? Are they that? Like, I heard that, like, it becomes like you enjoy this bit of like Schadenfreude takedown. And I remember saying to somebody in like March, the conversation was like, on my end, things are going too well and it makes me nervous because I see how it happens to other people. I'm not really a celebrity, but I'm sort of being like talked about like one and it's feeling very weird to me. Something's going to happen. The shoe's going to drop. This can't last forever. People are going to get tired of me. They're going to get annoyed by me because I'm everywhere. No one likes to see somebody everywhere, really. Something's going to happen. And I sort of said it as a joke, but it happened. And I think that it happened because, A, people were in a pandemic. They had nothing else to do but sit in their home and look at the internet. So everybody was watching the same channel at the same time. Mm-hmm. There was no diffusion of information. So it was our entertainment. It was like the first big scandal of the pandemic. It was gave something people to talk about. One of the people involved is a huge internet personality. People really feel feelings about them. And
talking about Chrissy Teigen.
Yeah, she's like a main character on the internet. So to be put in the same conversation with this person, I was then thrust into that level. But I think people in like the food industry were really unhappy with things that happened in their own personal life, at their career trajectory, at the magazines. Like, are things fair? Are things equitable? Like, why do white women always get the blah, blah, blah? Here I was, a white woman, getting a lot of attention. It was just like a perfect storm for people to be upset and angry. And I think I gave, by saying something stupid and careless, I gave a lot of people permission to publicly hate me.
Do you think it was stupid?
I think it's stupid in the way where you're like, oh, I shouldn't have said that. That was dumb. I think I should have rephrased it. I stand by the sentiments, frankly. It was not mindful or intelligent or to name names at all. I could have made the exact same point without calling anyone out.
Now that we have some distance from it, What is the point now that you still stand by?
The point is that I believe in something and I don't want to use the popularity that I've achieved and discrediting it by contradicting those beliefs.
So you described this once as anti-capitalist in my own weird fucked up way.
Yeah. I was like, I don't want you to buy more things.
Right.
But if I wanted to start a line of cookware, I could because people trust me.
Mm.
And I assume that I have some level of notoriety where people would buy it. But if I did that, I feel like I'm lying.
Contributing part of, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't believe we should own that many things, frankly. And I don't believe that the only way to become successful financially or otherwise is to like create more physical items in the world. What I was frustrated with was the idea that a person like me, unless I was willing to go down that path, could never really become successful. Because it's always the next path for anyone in the lifestyle category to be like, well, you've written books, you've done the thing, and now you have to make sheets at Walmart.
What do you mean by successful? Like, you understand that's very complicated because you're saying that, and yet before that moment,
mm-hmm.
you're like zooming with Colbert.
I mean, not as a friend. And but
yeah, but you've sold books. Like, I think
yeah.
to most people, you
that's
had achieved
it, yeah.
a certain level of success. You're saying that there was a next step.
Yeah, there's like a tier of person. I more was using the like Martha Stewart style, whatever, where
you
it's like.
You want to go to jail.
I did go to social jail. I went to emotional jail. It was terrible. When you think about, have I reached the ceiling by making books? If I choose to not go down that path.
Right.
What else is out there? How else do you build a business? Because the newsletter was focused on business. Like, how do you as a creative person get above a book?
To own a home upstate.
Yeah, exactly. Which I did do. It was like $200,000.
Okay.
I just mean like I still can't afford to buy in New York.
I'm not fact checking you. My last question on this, because I want to, we have other things to talk about, but I think it's important to understand this because I think you don't make this and the newsletter and home movies without this moment.
No, I don't think so either.
I think because I want to talk about all that. What's most damning or maybe is most unusual about your case is that usually when someone is quote unquote canceled, it's because something has been discovered about them.
Yeah.
That was previously a secret.
Yes. There's a skeleton in the closet.
But in your case, there was not an untoward revelation. It was just you being you. And I wondered, in the 3 years since that happened, did it force you to look more closely at how you move through the world, especially like in these racially charged times?
Yes and no, but I think that everybody in the summer of 2020 experienced something. Every single person, if you are a cognizant, emotionally aware individual of our time, everybody sort of was like, oh shit, and took a look at a lot of things in their life, how they act, how they behave, how they speak, who they know, what they support, how they move through the world. And whether or not that was like just for the summer and then they forgot all about it, or if it was like a lasting change deep within a person is up to the individual. But I think what happened to me was just that times a bajillion. But I'm the same exact person as I was before. And that was always my sort of personal outrage where I was like, I was just being myself the whole time. And all of a sudden someone was listening and I said something and it was taken in a way. And you know what I mean? But I think that undeniably, most people I know are slightly different after that summer, after the pandemic, after everything that happened. I also think that every single person that knew me before and knows me now knows that I'm the same person.
I guess I wonder then, you don't sound like someone that would say what they said anymore. In that way, you seem changed. It does seem like you
became more
mindful.
Oh, I mean, I just don't name names.
So you would, yeah, okay.
I don't feel differently about what I said. I don't feel differently about capitalism, about making
right.
things in the world, about being antithetical to a brand that you built, to celebrity culture, X, Y, and Z.
Right.
But those are just beliefs that I've had forever.
So how did you move forward in that moment when it all came tumbling down? Like, as a human being, how the hell did you carry on?
It was so fucking rough. I mean, I was also in a pandemic, like everyone else. I lived alone. I didn't have a significant other. I was just like in my apartment every day by myself crying. It was terrible. Because so many people already felt alone, but then to also feel like everybody hates you is so much worse.
How do you hold something like that?
I don't know. I had a lot of really amazing, wonderful people in my corner. And I think that that's also the thing that gets me through, just generally speaking, is knowing that, like, the people that love me, I think, are just, like, some of the most intelligent, emotionally evolved, sensitive, incredible people. They're funny, they're informed, they're caring, and, like, they all loved me through the whole thing. And they loved me before, they loved me during, they loved me after. And to know that those people are my community, I'm like, these are the people that remind me that I'm not the worst person in the world. They really kept me afloat, even though it was, like, a very difficult task.
I think, to provide context for people, you know, in the aftermath of this, mm-hmm. you lose the external work you had mm-hmm. at the Times, potential cooking shows, which forces you to create from within.
Mm-hmm. And for myself.
And for yourself, which you do, starting on June 17th.
Oh, God.
2020.
Are you going to read from that one?
I am.
Oh, my God. I feel, like, already embarrassed.
Okay. Well, you can be embarrassed, but I thought it was kind of moving, so
okay,
I'm going to read from
it. Thank you. Please do.
This is the first newsletter you send out. It includes a tuna salad recipe. That sounds normal. I want to read from one passage.
Okay.
You write, "Where I usually cope with stress, anxiety, etc., with food, the shopping for, cooking, and eating of, the last few weeks have been a struggle to find the joy in any of those activities. A true first in my 15 years of cooking professionally. So no, I wasn't cooking. I wasn't developing recipes. I wasn't working. Usually the recipes I write are pretty unfussed with reflection of what I'm genuinely excited to cook and eat, but pickles eaten directly from the jar and 2 Cadbury cream eggs are not recipes."
No, they're not. Oh my God, I was so depressed. Oh my goodness. That's a recipe for depression. Pickles out of the jar and 2 Cadbury cream eggs. My God. I want to give her a hug so bad.
That one line struck me. "The last few weeks have been a struggle to find joy in any of those activities. A true first in my 15 years of cooking professionally."
Mm-hmm.
In the sentence, you ended that line with an exclamation point.
That was to let people know that I wasn't, like, so depressed.
Yes.
You know?
But I thought it was a little bit of subterfuge. I read it as a period. And I just want to know, like, was creating this newsletter your way of rediscovering that joy?
It was a way for me to keep working. I didn't have a job. No one was going to hire me. It was so bad. It was unbelievably bad. And I felt so lucky to already have, like, an established base of individuals who had followed my work, most of whom, like, stuck by me through everything. And I didn't go to zero. I still had, like, a collective group of individuals who were like, "I believe in you. I still love you. I still turn to you for X, Y, and Z." But it was the first time where I was truly and really on my own without working for other people or a brand or a company. And I did it because I knew that I had to keep working, because if I didn't just start, and I knew that it wasn't going to be easy. The first few months were pretty rocky and the reception wasn't, like, 100% warm. So I was like, you know what? Newsletters, long form. People are going to either subscribe or they're not. And I was so moved by how many people did, but I wasn't cooking, because in the aftermath of whatever happened, it became conversations about a lot of different things. And it made me feel like I felt so much shame and embarrassment of just, like, existing, that the idea that I was going to put myself out there in any public way felt absolutely insurmountable.
But not just put yourself out there, but the reason I bring that passage up is because it reads really differently than any of the work that you did at the New York Times or Bon Appetit.
Yeah. It reads closer to the books, I think, especially this last one. But I think when you sort of, quote, lose everything, which I didn't lose everything. You know, I had my book deal still. Like, I was still on contract to make a third book.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, like, truly starting from nothing, but it was, like, a building that had caught fire. And you're like, I don't know if we're going to, like, raise the building or if we're going to try and salvage what's left.
So you salvaged what was left?
And I just rebuilt it in an entirely different style, like, for myself. But yeah, when you lose everything, you become less afraid of losing anything. And so I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it for myself. Because also, nothing is a sure thing. Your job could go away tomorrow. The deal could fall through tomorrow. Nothing is sure. No one's going to work as hard for you as you. No one's going to have your back like you. This was like a me on a raft in the middle of the ocean, truly alone.
You said before that moment, I wasn't a human person. I was just seen as the cooking lady.
Oof, dark. But, well, you know what's funny? So when I started writing the newsletter, the response was so positive and people were like, wow, I had no idea you could write. And I was like, I've been writing like 500 to 700 words in the New York Times every other week for 2 years. But people just Google the recipe and the writing isn't necessarily accompanied by that.
People are hungry reading your work.
Yeah.
We're trying
people
to get
to
the
put
meal.
Food on the table.
Myself included.
Yeah. So I started a blog.
What's it like to be a human being working in a public space?
It's tough and it's wonderful and it's hard and sometimes feels impossible. And sometimes I just can't imagine doing it another way. And I think that the greatest compliment that I could receive that I do often is that I'm the same person that people think I am by watching my videos, reading my books. It's the same person all the time, for better or for worse. And I think that the closer I get to sort of embracing imperfection, humanity, fallibility, mistakes, growth, ebbs and flows, and the more I can talk about that publicly, the more I feel secure in being myself in public.
What's unbelievable to me, this thing that you are doing now, the kind of work you're making in Home Movies and Sweet Enough, it's something you knew you wanted to do back when you gave that controversial interview in 2020. Because what people never quote back when they quote that interview are the first couple sentences, which I'd like to read.
Yeah, please.
You said, I'd rather stay small and always be myself. I'm interested in expanding myself as a writer. But at the same time, I do need to figure out how to turn this into money because you're making something and then it goes away.
Mm. I made something and it did go away and then it came back again.
It's like you knew it. I don't know if you wanted to get there the way you got there.
I didn't. People always say, like, do you regret it? Like, do you wish you could go back in time? And like, I think that there are a lot of personality fortifying things that come along with being publicly humiliated on like a massive scale.
Like what?
Net positive, you're just a kinder individual. At least I feel like I am. I think that if there's a possibility, like if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, by the way, like you did this interview with somebody 2 years ago and you said this thing and it like really hurt me, or like it really hurt my brother because he suffers from da 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 and what you said was actually really insensitive. You're going to be like, oh my God, I had no idea and I'm so sorry. And you're going to maybe become more aware of that because you're just out here living your life. You're speaking how you speak. You're a good person. You believe in good things. I think that once you know that all these people feel this way about you at once, at one time, the net progress from that is like always just kind of be above and beyond kind and nice and generous. And that is probably the biggest and most obvious shift that can come from being like decimated publicly.
You took definitely the long way home.
Yeah. You know, I could have done that. I mean, not that I wasn't nice before. I think that I'm a nice, I don't know. Some people might still think I'm not nice. I don't know. But like, oh yeah, no, everything I've done has taken the long way. I've been doing this for so long now. Everything has been the long, hard way. But I don't know. I think that makes you more interesting.
Well, we started with pastries and dessert. And mm-hmm. I thought we'd end here.
Mm.
To think about that past self and now the present self.
Mm-hmm.
You have this quote in the book. As a member of the pastry department, you're talking about yourself at 19, 20. We were the least respected and the most dismissed, but still we made everyone bread pudding. Imagine being treated like shit every day, but still showing up with a full hotel pan of warm, custardy dessert. Maybe we just wanted to be liked, and everyone knows a great way to be liked is to show up with something delicious. Is this why I got into cooking? Lots to unpack. Well,
that reads like a diary entry. I can't believe we just published that in the book. They're like, no notes, everything.
I think you got paid some good money for it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so as we leave, is it why you got into cooking? And also now, what's your reason for still doing this work?
Mm. I do think that there is a level of anybody who cooks professionally, be it a cookbook author in a restaurant, a caterer, any sort of form of hospitality, there's a desire to care for people. There's a desire to people please. There is a desire to nurture. And if that is because you didn't have nurturement or care growing up, or if that's just because you had an abundance of it and you enjoy it, there's a lot of ways to get there. It's not always rooted in trauma. But I do think that that is like a common thread for people that do that, because it's such hard work and it's like a very ephemeral, you know, especially in restaurants where you just like feed people and then you go home. That's also part of why I pivoted, I think, to books and writing, because it felt more lasting. It felt more meaningful. I'm passing off knowledge. Like now you're doing it at home. Like it becomes part of your life. It has like a longer lifespan. It's always nice to know that you can like fill your home if you're like, I'm making dinner. It's a small gesture to be like, oh, I brought you cookies or something like, oh, like who's going to be mad at that? That's just like a simple, nice, sweet thing. Or to invite someone into your home feels very intimate. It's like a fast track to intimacy in a way that like nothing really else is. It's so important, I think, in like the fiber of every single culture in the world. It feels like the through line and people's memories and their families and traditions, like almost everything's rooted in food. And it's still my favorite thing in the world. I've never found anything that makes me happier.
You know, you're describing why you do what you do. And I guess my last question for you, when you're not moving, when you're not cooking, when you're not prepping, when you're not shopping,
mm-hmm.
and you're left with you now in this moment,
mm-hmm.
on the heels of all that happened, how do you feel about yourself?
I feel really proud. I don't feel sorry for myself. I never did. I made my bed. I laid in it. But like, I felt like, fuck, I have to get out of this. And then I did. Like, I kind of felt proud before, but I maybe felt more entitled to my success because I had like been working at it for so long. And now I just feel like proud and grateful and excited. I feel free. I feel like I can kind of do anything that I want. I'm excited to like do things that I don't know how to do yet. I'm excited to like challenge myself. And what I love about this book tour and La Media and press that I've done so far, especially this podcast, for the first time in my whole life, my whole career, I'm able to talk about like why I love cooking or why I got into it or the like really deep rooted emotional and intellectual parts of like what make this a career. And it is so much more gratifying to me than like what makes a recipe go viral. I'm like, I don't know. And I don't really care. But like this, I care about the connective tissue of being a human person and caring about something passionately, making it your career pursuit, and like spending the rest of your life trying to get better at it. I hope this is the best cookbook I ever make until the next cookbook. And I hope each book is better than the next. And I hope that a person who can read all of them looks at them and says, wow, what an evolution. I think that books are time capsules, and I feel lucky to be able to write them because it really is like charting the evolution and growth of a person if you put enough of yourself into it.
So this book really is like uncharted territory.
I feel like it is. I didn't expect that, but it makes a lot of sense because it was my first job here. It's been like wildly emotional talking about because I'm like thinking about that 19-year-old person and how much I believed in this and had no idea that this is where I'd end up ever. It was not the plan, but I didn't have one. And sometimes when you enter in a situation and you're like, I'm so jazzed by this, like I'm so satisfied and stimulated and excited, I have no idea where this is going to take me. Like, how freeing is that? And that's kind of how I feel right now today. I'm just like, I have no idea what's going to happen in the next year or two, but I feel like it's going to be really good because I feel really happy and proud of the work that I'm making.
Well, and it's in that work that I too charted some uncharted territory with that raspberry ricotta cake.
And baby's first whisk.
It was not my first whisk.
It's your first whisk with a capital W.
It was the first with a capital W.
Okay, so how was the cake?
Really good.
Okay. Were you surprised that it was really good?
I was shocked because I did it.
Mm.
I was unsurprised because I was following your recipe.
Oh, thank you. That's very sweet. Why did you pick that recipe? Out of curiosity.
It just looked appealing and it looked simple.
Yeah. It makes sense. If you were to say, what's the first one I should start with? That would be like one of the two or three recipes I'd recommend for sure.
You know, much like the inflection points we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
I chose the ricotta cake because it just seemed right. I was following some instinct.
Yeah. Instinct is really underplayed, I think, when we talk about career.
It seems to be your through line.
It is. Yeah.
How did you think my cake was going to turn out?
I don't think you would have brought it up if it was a failure.
Because of my personality type?
Because you're not trying to set me up for failure. You're considerate, I think. You're a very caring individual. I think you care a lot about people. But I also think that I know that cake recipe really well. And I know that it works. So barring any sort of like, you know, and my oven turned off in the middle of it, or I added four eggs instead of two. Like, you know, I thought I was ready for like a twist.
No.
Or praise.
It was fantastic.
Okay. I'm so, so glad to hear that.
Last thing. You said, I can't wait for these next 2 years. If we were to like listen back on this, what do you hope for?
What do I hope for? I hope to have another book to talk about. I hope to have my family get started. I'm looking to start a family.
Is that why you came on the show?
Yes. What are you doing in the next year? No.
It's an advertisement?
We're having a family. No. I have, the position has been filled. this book feels very chapter ending and also chapter beginning at the same time. And so I feel like in 2 years, I hope to be continually surprised in a good way. I hope to do new types of work. I hope to continue to be lucky enough to like make a living off of effectively just being myself and teaching people how to cook.
Well, I so look forward to that next chapter, and I thank you for going through all the previous ones with me.
Absolutely.
On this show.
Yes.
Allison Roman, a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to give us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. I want to give a special thanks this week to the team at Shelter PR and, of course, our guest, Allison Roman. You can find her new cookbook, Sweet Enough, wherever you do your reading. To learn more about Allison and her work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more conversations like this one, I'd recommend our talks with Michelle Williams, David Sedaris, Abby Jacobson, Ocean Vuong, Natasha Lyonne, Brittany Packnett Cunningham, and George Saunders. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. As always, Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janik Sobravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's talk was edited by Clarice Guevara and Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editor is CJ Mitchell. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Sineca. Special thanks to Kaylin Un. I'd also like to thank our team at Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julie Martin, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Morgan Ratner, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Navarez, Maya Koenig, Carly Migliori, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next Sunday with Betty Gilpin. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
See new things. Try new things. Go back centuries while living in the moment. Forge new paths while discovering old ones. Pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
Awards Watch says Liam Neeson is at his best. Don't miss In the Land of Saints and Sinners. Having left his dark past behind, retired hitman Finbar Murphy, played by Neeson, leads a quiet life in a remote coastal Irish town. But when a menacing crew of terrorists arrive, Finbar is drawn into a vicious game of cat and mouse, forcing him to choose between exposing his secret identity or defending his friends and neighbors. In the Land of Saints and Sinners, from Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Watch it now on digital. Rated R.